Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Anyone who has dealt with an aging parent has had one of those moments where the only thing you can do is laugh, sometimes through tears. But for writer and comic Barry Friedman, his long, repetitive, sometimes incredibly frustrating conversations with his father, Jack Friedman, were, in hindsight, pretty darn funny. At 78, Jack Friedman moved from the East Coast to Las Vegas, where Barry was often performing. And Barry became his de facto caregiver, helping him, spending time with him, embedding himself within Jack's elderly friend set, spent time at buffets at the casinos, bowling, and long conversations with a man who had opinions on everything and who couldn't hear that well himself and never really listened to boot. Barry began sharing these stories, first on Facebook and later on a Substack, and through social media, more and more people came to feel they knew Jack Friedman. In fact, by the time Jack moved to Tulsa late in life, he was a minor celebrity of sorts, something he seemed to take in stride in a peculiar Jack Friedman style. Barry began assembling these stories into book form when Jack's health began a downward slide this fall, and he passed away in November last year. Now the first collection is out. It's titled, well, you can't say the title on radio. I'll say Jack Shot, if you will. Voluptuous Bagels and Other Concerns of Jack Friedman. Barry Friedman will be talking about and signing his book tomorrow evening at 7 o'clock at Magic City Books. And our longtime commentator joins me today as our guest. Barry Friedman, it's a pleasure to have you back with us.
Yeah, it's good to be here. Thanks. Good seeing you again, actually.
Yes, it is. This new book, the subject of which is something you've been writing about, conversations between you and your father for a number of years online in various guises. And there are people all around Tulsa, and really around the country,
yeah,
that who would say they know Jack Friedman, your father, even if they've never met him. Tell me about this decision to write about him.
You know, when my mom died in 1999 and my father moved out to Las Vegas when he was 78, and I spent a lot of time in Vegas as a stand-up comedian. I was working at a lot of the clubs, and I thought, well, this would be great. He loves Vegas, and so he goes out to Vegas. And I had a lot of time on my hands because I was a comedian and didn't work all the time, or in his case, didn't work at all. How do you live, Barry? And so I would go out and spend weeks with him, literally plugging in his printer or moving the hutch or making sure his blood pressure medicine was in the right plastic bin. And I would just hang out with him for a week or two, going to buffets or seeing his friends. And I started writing on Facebook, it first started, some of these stories. And I kept writing more and more stories, and I noticed that people were following along and actually wondering some of the things about Jack Friedman that just astonished me. Like, my father had a cousin, Bernie, who he told me died, but he didn't remember that he told me Bernie died. So every time he would come up, I'd say, you know, Bernie died. Bernie died. How did he die? Go, I don't know. You told me. And so people were chiming in about where Bernie was. And I thought, well, everybody has fathers and mothers, or had mothers and fathers, or had relationships, or have relationships. This is very flattering that they actually cared about mine. So I wrote more and more of these stories out in Vegas, and then he moved to Tulsa. I dragged him out of Vegas, if you want to have his take on it. And he lives in an apartment, the Mansion House, over at 16th and Carson. Mm-hmm. But of course, when he told people he lived at the Mansion House, he didn't tell them it was the Mansion House. He just said it was the mansion. And there was, like, there was one mansion in Tulsa, and he had it. So that was the second, that'll be the second volume. And the third volume, I kept writing these stories on Facebook and then Substack. The third volume was when he moved into the Tulsa Jewish Community Retirement Center, Zarrow Point, which he decided was the Hebrew home. And so that's how this all started. And the more I wrote, the more I wanted to write, and then the more I thought about writing. And we get into these situations where I go, oh, this is going to be a great story. And it just sort of built on from there. And enough people tell you, hey, turn this into a book, turn this into a book. And I thought, well, he read it all, unless you want it in the book. So I decided, let's see what it would look like if I put it in the book. And my publisher said, yeah, let's go ahead and do this. And then my father died in November, and the first volume was supposed to come out in May. And he said, let's move it up. And That's how the volume came out, as quickly as it did after his death.
Yeah. You said he read everything you wrote about
No,
him.
He read nothing I wrote. No. In fact, he would say, I guess the most absurd comment he ever gave me about this project was, somebody mentioned to him that I was writing him on Facebook. He didn't know what Facebook was. But he said, are you getting rich off my fame? There just isn't enough wrong with that sentence. And he literally did not read anything I wrote. The Tulsa World had a story on us one time. He didn't go to the jump page. I mean, he saw his picture. He got that. But he never went to the jump page. So if you said, you know, people would say, you know, Jack, did you read about what Barry wrote about you today? Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, he just didn't. I mean, he clearly loved me. He clearly knew what I was doing for him. He just never quite got that into what I do. It was astonishing.
And it was, as I said, he became sort of this minor celebrity among circles that read your writing. So total strangers would come up and say, hi, Jack, you know, how you doing?
Yeah,
I remember. And he just took it in stride?
First of all, he was kind of amused by it all. And then he was amused by it all. And he'd say things a lot like somebody would come up to him. Like Kathy Taylor, when she was my mayor, we met at the bagel place, which he called Owlhead, which nobody knows why. But we're at Owlhead. And I know Kathy Taylor enough to say hello. And she said she loved the stuff about my father. I said, well, he's sitting right there. You want to go meet him? And she goes, I'd love to meet him. And I said, well, come meet him. And I said, Dad, this is Mayor Kathy Taylor. At first, he commented on the fact that we had a woman mayor. And then he felt the need to say to her, I'm the father. Because he clearly thought he was not a 90-year-old man or didn't look like a 90-year-old man. And so he wanted to tell people that we looked like brothers to him. So he was the father.
A couple of things that always struck me about your writings about you and your dad. The first is it's pretty relatable for a lot of people who have dealt with an aging parent. Right. How much of that was part of the reason you decided to write about him?
None. I did not think about the relatability of it all. I wanted to see, I guess I wanted to see if I could make this interesting enough for people who didn't know either one of us. Mm-hmm. I thought there was probably a story to tell about fathers and sons in the moment. There's not a lot in the book that's
reflective.
Very little that's melancholy.
There's a little bit.
A little bit. But it was never, I remember my dad at 40. You know, my sister actually made the comment. She goes, and he was doing this at 40. He just had more energy. And so it hit me that there might be something to the relationship right now between a 60, 65-year-old son and a 90, 95-year-old father. Without that, clearly he's going to die soon, and I knew he was going to die. I just put it this way. I knew he wasn't going to live forever. I just didn't think he was going to die, if that makes any sense. Mm-hmm. And so I thought in these moments, like when we'd go down to Florida to see his 98-year-old brother, these were moments that probably had some resonance with people, certainly did with me, and they were just funny, and the relationships were just hilarious. And dysfunctional, and everything that a lot of families go through. Only with my father and me, there was no darkness that we had to go through. There was no anger we had to work through. And that was important to me also, because I did know when, you know, my mother died and even when my son died that, you know, you really don't want to fix that relationship or try to fix it the 35 minutes while you're on their deathbed. Mm. And it wasn't the most important moment in their life. And so when my father eventually would die, as I knew that that moment wasn't going to be the most important moment. And maybe the most important moment would be him in Florida with his brother arguing about whether it was raining or whether that was just water or drops.
And there's a lot of that. And, you know, one reads those passages that suggest that maybe Jack is losing some of his cognitive functions and abilities. And I kept thinking it's that thing that your sister wrote, which is right in the opening pages of the book. He's always been this way.
Well, that's the thing. I like to say that my father, the last 20 years of his life, couldn't hear, didn't listen, had no short-term memory, and didn't care. So it was the perfect storm of father-son relationships. But on a quasi-serious note, in looking at all this material over the last 20 years, I can see the decay start to happen. Yeah. I can see the moments that no longer register, the phone calls he no longer made, the relationships he no longer remembered. So that was pretty evident to me as it was going on. Now, in writing the book, I actually am trying to figure out how much I should call attention to that, you know, with the lens pulled out writing now, or whether I just relay how it was in, you know, 2011 when he was better.
Yeah. The second thing I thought that struck me as interesting about this writing is that You know, these stories are funny. Sometimes they're hilarious. But it seemed to me there is that undercurrent of, if not sadness, this sort of tinge of reality and poignancy that emerges on the nature of aging, of the loss that accompanies aging, like friends.
Right.
And the ability to remember if friends have died or not, of independence, which that happens later, perhaps not so much in this, well, somewhat in this book as well. You know, the loss of body functions, physical and cognitive. Mm-hmm. And I guess as a caregiver, was that really obvious to you? Because you had a daily reminder, at least for the last part of his life.
Yeah, that's a good question. It was, you know, equal parts exhausting and exhilarating. Mm-hmm. I mean, he literally would not remember that his wife, my mother, had died. He would call me and say, "Where's your mother?" And I knew if that phone call came after 7 p.m. that Sundowners was probably kicking in. Yeah. If the phone rang after 7 and it was my father, I knew it was not going to be a good conversation. But when he would say, "Where's your mother?" So the question then is, well, do you tell him that his wife died? And if Alzheimer's has kicked in, you're going to have to tell him every day that his wife died, and you're going to have to go through those same emotions every day. And I thought, well, let me try something else. So what I said to him was, I said she died, but I also quickly added, "But you know she died, Dad. You remember this. You're just confused at the moment." And what I noticed about my father, even towards the end, he was more upset that he couldn't remember than the event took place, which meant you could get through it. You could say, "Dad, you're fine. You just momentarily forgot." And he'd say, "Why does the mind do this?" And go, "Because you're 95 and you're old." And that would sort of slide us through. But he never had to hear that his wife died for the first time again and again and again, which was actually I was grateful for, because I didn't know how I was going to do that when he started taking that news as badly as one would.
My guest today is Barry Friedman. He's a writer, comedian, and essayist. His latest book is titled,
I decided to call it something you cannot advertise, Jack Stuff, only it's not Jack Stuff, it's not Jack Shoot.
It could be Jack Shot.
Jack Shot. Because, a typo, yeah.
Because there's an asterisk for that vowel sound.
Yeah.
But we know what that means. Yeah. And it's the subtitles, Voluptuous Bagels and Other Concerns of Jack Friedman.
You know where that came from, right?
Tell me about Voluptuous Bagels.
Well, we used to go to Owlhead Bagels, which is old school bagels on 35th and Peoria.
Which is what he called it.
And he called it Owlhead. He doesn't remember calling it Owlhead, but he called it Owlhead. And he used to get a sandwich, which was just an egg on a bagel. That's it. That's all he wanted. Well, one time I got him that, and he thought the bagel was just too much. He couldn't eat the bagel. Why do they make the bagels so big? They're too voluptuous. I go, "What?" He goes, "The bagels are just too voluptuous. You know what I mean?" I go, "Yeah, I know what voluptuous means." He goes, "They're just too big." He goes, "Get me a soft roll." Because in New York, they have soft rolls. Yeah. They have hard rolls. They have soft rolls. So I got him a croissant. So every day when we go to Owlhead, which was, you know, 2-3 times a week, and usually on Saturdays, that was the big day, you'd get him an egg sandwich, which was a croissant and an egg. Now, sometimes they heated it up, and then it was too gosh darn hot. And so he'd complain about that. So then they didn't toast the croissant. But the voluptuous bagel came from the back. He could no longer have bagels because they were too big, too voluptuous. And so he had many concerns, but voluptuous bagel was one of them.
And that's one thing that keeps recurring throughout this book is these various descriptors that Jack, very unique descriptors of things. And I'm guessing Yiddish was not spoken in your house growing up.
Oh, it was, but badly.
Badly.
Yeah.
And in fact, you learned how badly only in adulthood.
Yeah. So what happened was we go to Las Vegas, and New York had only been open maybe a year or two. We go through the New York casino, and my father says, "This place is a Heusengemach." And I go, "What is that?" He goes, "Heusengemach. Don't you know Yiddish?" I go, "No, I don't know Yiddish. Heusengemach. It means mess, crazy, not laid out properly." So I'm using Heusengemach like that's what it means. So you remember Harry Sebrin, cantor Harry Sebrin. Yeah. Well, his wife, Alice Sebrin, I was friends with. We go to lunch one time. I throw out the word Heusengemach because I know Yiddish. She goes, "What?" I go, "Heusengemach." And I explained to her what Heusengemach means. She goes, "Barry, that's not what it means." I go, "It's not?" She goes, "No. Heusengemach means Heusen, which is pants, Mach or Macher, which is maker. It means pants maker." So I said to my father, "Hey, listen, by the way, Heusengemach does not mean mess. It means pants maker." He goes, "Where do you get your information?" I go, "From a cantor's wife. She doesn't know what she's talking about." So they spoke Yiddish, but it was really badly. And so I learned really bad Yiddish. But the older, this is a terrible generalization, but the older Jews get, the more Yiddish they speak.
Yeah.
Badly. But it's amazing to me that, yeah, that was, he would say things, and sometimes he'd get it right, and he was never completely wrong about his stories, like the toupee story. Mm. All right. He wore the worst toupees imaginable. I mean, think of the worst toupee ever, worse than that. They were women's hair pieces that he would buy online, and they'd have names when they'd come in boxes, like Celeste. They're serious. Fauna. He put them on his head and then look in the mirror and then cut them himself. Because what could go wrong with that? And so one time, one hair piece was just astonishingly bad. And I said, Dad, you have to stop buying hair that comes in a box that you cut yourself. He said, what do you want me to do? That's the way they come. Well, he's not entirely wrong. That is the way they come. But never thought, hey, maybe there's another place to get a toupee.
And I think getting him to rid himself of toupees was a big story.
He was over the house, and Melissa, my girlfriend at the time, now my wife, were sitting there. She says, Jack, you got to take off the toupee. And he just took it off there at the dining room table, put it on the table, and started yelling at it. He goes, you're done. You're through. You had a good life, but now you're out of here. I don't want you anymore. So I took him right to Target. I said, we got to get you a hat. He said, do they got hats here? I go, if there's a God, they do. And ever since then, he took it off, yeah.
Interesting.
But in retrospect, I should have let him wear the toupee till the day he died, because it hit me. That toupee was Samson to him. It just gave him strength. He actually thought of himself as a 50, 60, 70-year-old man. And he would take off the toupee, he'd pass a mirror, and once in a while he'd say, where's my hair? Or I'm getting old. And I actually think that toupee made him think he was younger than he was. And in retrospect, probably, so what if the rest of us looked at it and didn't look at it? I think to him it gave him some sense of invincibility.
This book picks up as your father moved from the East Coast to Vegas in the 1970s, as you mentioned. 2000, I'm sorry. He was in his 70s.
Yes.
And the book is billed as sort of a reintroduction of sorts between the two of you. Was that really the case? Because I think you've always had contact with him, but obviously there was a very different sort of contact when he was in Vegas because you were working in Vegas.
Yeah, we always had a good relationship. I mean, never had a bad period at all. And after my mom died, and she was really the one who's the director in the house, she kept things moving. And so he was actually lost a little. He needed that direction. And my brother was in California. He worked full time. My sister was in New York. She worked full time. And so it just seemed like I was the one to do this. And I enjoyed doing it. I loved doing it. And it just, so the relationship strengthened because I saw him a lot. And I saw him a lot in that role of, I literally took over the decision making. Now, you know, with older parents, you have to somehow let them keep their dignity, but not spend 4 hours about which Chinese restaurant you're going to go to. You sort of just go, we're going here, we're doing this. And so that was important to me, that he would have somebody he could rely on. And one time he actually called and said, he almost got there. He said, Barry, what you do for me, nobody else could do. I love you. I know you love me. You know, your sister, by the way, she works. Your brother's sophisticated. So, you know, thank you. What? One is working, the other sophisticated. It falls on you. Dad, you almost had the compliment. You're almost there.
As you began seeing him much more, now you were seeing him when you were working in New York or in Atlantic City, but as you began seeing him more, were there any surprises in how he was reacting with the world?
When he got to Tulsa, one of the surprises is as personable as he was, as I remembered him being growing up, he was actually not as friendly as I thought he would be. When he moved into the Hebrew home, for instance, he didn't remember anybody's name. And maybe that just comes from just not remembering names. But he wasn't a social butterfly. He didn't do all the activities. He watched a lot of TV. He was very friendly when he'd go downstairs to eat. And I think one of the reasons the staff loved him so much was that, you know, there's a crankiness as you get older. And he was never cranky. He was forgetful. He was inappropriate. My God. But he was never mean to them. And so I think what surprised me was he was not quite as outgoing as I thought he would be. And that might have been because he knew he wasn't all there anymore. And that was one of the things that hit me. My friend Jerry Eisenberg, my second favorite nonagenarian Jew, told me that he goes, and he would read it. He'd said, I think your father knows what's going on, and I think he enjoys running a game on you. And I think he's a little uncomfortable in social settings while being, again, completely comfortable in his own element. There was this one moment in Las Vegas. Actually, it was here at the casino here where I went up to him. He was talking to these two women, and he just started talking to them as he normally would do in his old days. And they walked away, and I said, Dad, who was that? He goes, just two women came up and said hello. They know me from some reason. Well, they knew them from the blog. They know me from some reason. I go, that's kind of nice. And the next thing he said was, you know, I think the big one wants me. Wow. And to him, he didn't think there was anything wrong with a 40-year-old woman coming on to a 90-year-old man. He thought it was something special about his 90-year-oldness.
Well, one of the things you did do, and you sort of relate a few stories about this in the book, is stories that you took for granted as a youth that he had told about himself, you began to investigate.
Well, he had a Purple Heart. He was awarded a Purple Heart. Originally, the story was he was in the Philippines putting up a bridge. The enemy started shelling. The sergeant said, drop what you're doing and run for your life. And then my father says, so I dropped what I was doing, boom. He actually always did the story with the boom. The bridge part fell on his toe, broke his toe nail. And next thing you know, he wakes up in a MASH-style hospital in Tokyo. I don't know. And
wait a minute.
Yeah, exactly. This is the first part of the story. And he has a Purple Heart from his war injury. Now, apparently back in the old days, they literally gave out Purple Hearts. Just there were no big ceremonies, but they just threw them on the bed. All right. He has a Purple Heart. Like, you see the Purple Heart. It's not engraved on his discharge papers. There's something really weird about the typeface, like somebody else typed in Purple Heart recipient, like him, right? And I said to him at one point, this Purple Heart. Yeah, I got a Purple Heart. Well, about 20 years after the first telling of the story, he tells me that after the bomb went off and he was injured, his knee, his hearing, a lot of things went wrong at that point. He goes, I was in bed and I woke up, went to the bathroom. When I came back, there was a Purple Heart on my bed. And then he said, I think it was my bed. I go, what? He goes, I think it was my bed. I don't remember. I go, that could be somebody else's Purple Heart. You've stolen somebody's Purple Heart. He goes, no, let it go. Like I'm going to go find the guy. And then the story concludes with there's this big fire in St. Louis in 1972 where everybody's medical records from how many years, both World Wars, burns to the ground. They were never digitalized. So nobody knows if he had it. I can't find out if it's his Purple Heart or not. I would think maybe, but nowhere. There's no record of it. There's nothing on the Purple Heart, nothing on the discharge papers, which proves it. But again, he told people he was a Purple Heart recipient. And he ran with it. And when people would say, thank you for your service, he kind of looked at them like, what? Well, Dad, you saved the whole damn thing. And so they're thanking you for your service. And again, not to make complete light of it, he was there.
Yeah.
This 19, 20-year-old scared kid from Brooklyn, like millions of 19, 20-year-old scared kids from all over the country, did save the whole damn thing. And so give him credit for that, even if he did steal someone's Purple Heart.
But we don't know.
No, we don't know.
The name of the book by Barry Friedman. I can't say it on the air.
Jack Friedman.
Yeah. It's Voluptuous Bagels and Other Concerns of Jack Friedman. It's the first volume of writing that Barry Friedman has been doing about he and his father for, since right around 2000
yeah.
or so.
Yeah.
And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. There'll be a signing on Thursday at Magic City Books.
Yes, 7 o'clock.
And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. You know, I think some of the funnest parts of the book are his interactions with family and the group that you referred to as the mob, because this is in his Las Vegas years, and we're not talking about the real mob. It's the group of other senior citizens that would get together on a regular basis.
It was the survivors group is what they call themselves, because they all had, they all outlasted their spouses. And it was Jeanette, who was his girlfriend, his long-suffering girlfriend. And he would never mention Jeanette's name without telling us, she buried two husbands. that's so concerned him that if he actually married her, she buried, like she literally buried, like it was her fault. She buried two husbands. There was Carol, who was married to Ed, who fell over in a Jeep. That was part of the story. There was Ed, who married Vicky Mustard. There were three Vickys in my father's life. Vicky Mustard, Vicky Schwartz, and Vicky, his real estate agent, in that order. And Lou was an insurance salesman from Philadelphia. And there was Ed, a cop from Indiana. And there was another Jewish guy from Indiana. And my father would say, imagine that, a Jew from Indiana. I go, yeah, they have them. We're all over, Dad, really. But he used to love pigeonholing people because I think it made him feel comfortable. Because, I mean, one of the things when I brought him to Tulsa, he joined a bowling league. And I picked him up one day, and he was really unhappy about the bowling league. I go, what's the matter? He goes, there's nobody to talk to. How can there be nobody to talk to? You're bowling with 8 or 9, 10, 15, 20 guys. He goes, nah, it's not the same. What's not the same? I must have Jews in my bowling league. So he was he was a terrible Jew, but he knew he was Jewish. He felt Jewish. He thought Judaism, Jewishness was in the blood. Mm. So he enjoyed being with people that reminded him of his youth in Brooklyn, I guess.
What's been the reaction to, I know you had tremendous reaction from the stories as you were putting them online. What's been the reaction to the book so far?
Similar. I mean, I actually picked up an agent who read some of the passages and then found the old stories online. It still resonates with people who've had relationships with their father and just enjoy seeing a relationship in the flesh without too much darkness.
And drama.
Yeah. And mostly fun. And not a lot of, this is what Alzheimer's does to a person. You can see what it does to a person. You can see the stories. You can see his, you know, mind going in and out of things. But the reaction is exactly what I wanted it to be. I'm actually concerned about people like you who've read all those blogs and all those posts, whether in book form it works. Because in the old days, you know, you'd read something about Jack on Monday, and maybe I write something about him on Wednesday. Well, now you turn the page and it's there, and I don't know whether it still works. So far, the reviews seem to be that it does. I try to add a bit of a narrative to it, you know, as a glue, but that's probably my biggest concern about it. But so far, the reaction from the book is the same as the reaction from the blogs.
The name of the book is Jack?
Stuff.
Shoot. Yeah.
Shot.
Yeah. Voluptuous Bagels and Other Concerns of Jack Friedman, the story of the writing between Barry Friedman and his father. Barry, thanks very much for joining
us. Thank you.
Writer, comic, and frequent Studio Tulsa commentator, Barry Friedman, speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa about his new collection about his father. Unfortunately, I can't say the name of the book on the air. Let's just call it Jack Shot, Volume 1, Voluptuous Bagels and Other Concerns of Jack Friedman. It's published by Babylon Books. There'll be a signing tomorrow evening at 7 o'clock at Magic City Books, and you can learn more at magiccitybooks.com. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.